we got them at 104.1 FM, Berkeley Virgin Radio, on TuneIn and Streama and everything like that. Well, you might have to drive around West Oakland Park to find us on 104.1 FM, but the long haul is always the first and third Thursday, 3124 Shattuck, about 7:30 is our organizational meeting, and you can join and have a mic all to yourself for $20 a month, 2 hours a week, and...
I'm
ahorita recordamos cuando los 40,000, ¿cómo se dice? Headmen. We remember when the 40,000 headmen were rampaging in Central America. And the guide to the end of the world from that story was Dorsey escorting the Contra to the hospital, get the bullet out of his head. Of course, now Ortega has returned to Nicaragua and leftist revolutionaries in power over Latin America, although in El Salvador, even though they voted the FLN back, they're now getting kind of the Honduran treatment, where Mr. Bill looks like sick to death squads just under drone bomber. But okay, now that 40,000 headmen are being mopped up in Iraq and Syria, and Webster's going to talk about that in the World Crisis Radio, fitting naturally in the endless bad news horror story of the Mouse Report. Does the DJ Mouse, founding member of the Bolsheviks Anonymous, realize that only by appealing to power higher than ourselves can we overcome disabilities and be happy hippies, and happy hippies don't kill people?
Through these fields of destruction, baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your suffering as the battle reached time, and only the enemies were back in the fear and the alarm. Thank you. let me bid you farewell. Every man has to die, but it's written in the stars, in every line in your palm, we're fools to make one.
Of the My Lai massacre and so many other things, and often quite useful in terms of the Guta chemical weapons fraud of August, September 2013. Seymour Hersh, quite useful at that point. This one, I think, not useful. Military to military, it's in the London Review of Books, number one of 7th of January, 2016, and he wants to tell you, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, director of the DIA between 2012 and 2014, confirmed that his agency had sent a constant stream of classified warnings to the civilian leadership about the dire consequences of toppling Assad. Now, the irony here is that we don't hear anything about the big attempt to topple Assad, which was in the summer, I believe, July of 2012, which was the attempt to decapitate the entire Syrian leadership. And they had an inside person who brought bombs in and so forth. So now Michael Flynn is trying to restore his own virginity on this matter by saying, oh, yeah, we were trying to help Assad all the time. And he said the jihadists were controlling the opposition. Turkey wasn't doing enough to stop the smuggling of foreign fighters and weapons across the border, says Michael Flynn. My God, Turkey is masterminding the smuggling of foreign fighters and weapons across the border. So all of this stuff looks like a lot of flim-flam. Dempsey said that the fall of the Assad regime would lead to chaos and potentially to Syria's takeover by jihadi extremists, much as was then happening in Libya. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Let's go back again. Carly Fiorina in that, one of the biggest warmongers, right? She knows what she's doing. And, here's what she says. Republican debate, December 15th. One of the things I would immediately do, in addition to defeating them here at home, is to bring back the warrior class.
Oops, I wasn't going to step in political doo-doo on this Mouse Report, but way back at the beginning here, sometime around like zero on this time thing, well, maybe not quite. You know it's Webster Tire Place. Let's try a minute.
Tried to satirize his Candide. Well, we
Webster.
Are optimistic, so we wish to...
Oh, that's right. The season's greetings. We know it's Christmas.
It looks now like the siege is essentially over. It's time to mop up. There's mopping up action going on in Ramadi against the...
Now I remember what I was going to say. In the previous Contra War, that was the horrible 80s. It was Central America. Now it's South Central Asia and all. So the Mideast, basically, everything from Afghanistan to Libya, Syria, Sudan, and in between. Those are the countries listed by Wesley Clark on Pentagon's post 9/11 hit list when we had an air defense holiday for drones to be matched by the, speaking of drones, let's go to our favorite Stockholm Syndrome hostage, the star of Dances with Donors, a recent Mouse Report on Indie Bay. So let me go to Samori Marksman, because I remember Covert Action had a CAIB or Phil Agee's thing, had an obit for Samori. It was 99, of course, you're going to take over as they did in 99. You got to knock out the... There was a heart attack epidemic, right? Andrea, Gina, Hota, Andrea Lewis, Father Bill, spate of heart attacks. Berkeley's heart attack epidemic. They must have done something right. No good deed goes unpunished. Pacifica's original Democracy Now! Is hijacked. Democracy Now! Started out as a noble and ambitious idea. Pacifica had 5-station network in major markets. And, of course, all these characters are trying to sell those 4 states and WBIs down the river by breaking up. That's what the whole Bugsy Siegel gang is in. And he comes in and he soaks Pacifica for zillions, hundreds of thousands in single judgments based on racism, when these are the crooks that are embezzling the stuff and get fired because of that. And then you're going to front, disgusting, never mind. Because he says the right things when they give him the mic, and he knows he's got to build up his rep. So anyway, Democracy Now! Started out by Samori Marksman. Okay, the idea was developed, but it didn't have a signature. Democracy Now! Started out as a noble and ambitious idea. Pacifica had a 5-station network in major markets and college stations and smaller market affiliates, but except for its news hour, it didn't have a signature national program. The idea was to develop one, but what should it be? Program directors and selected programmers from Pacifica's 5 stations and other contributors decided by consensus that the program should tackle the issues of the day, generate new audiences, and drop on and showcase house talent. It should be a news magazine format and should feature on a rotating basis hosts from every Pacifica station who in turn would bring new voices to the air. The goal ultimately was that the program would have a uniquely Pacifica imprint and would reflect its commitment to serving informational needs of its diverse audiences. It was agreed that although a network-wide project, the program would be produced in New York at WBAI under the directorship of its program director, Samori Marksman, who we lost in 1999, and who the folks who made Covert Action magazine gave the inside back page obit. Who had originally conceived the DN program concept. Of course, now, just a DJ Mouse aside, what is called democracy started in the USA as declaring everyone, the Indians, that is, the native people, that is, as enemy who could not vote. If you did not have property, you could not vote. If you were property, you could not vote. If you were a woman, you could not vote. So most of the people, of course, couldn't vote. It was a minority rule, and it was dubbed majority rule. How funny is that? Not very. I must be sick. So that's democracy, DN for short. Where did it say DN? Because then program concept, logistical and programmatic issues were worked out, and DN was ready to make its debut. But a huge problem arose that created tensions throughout Pacifica. Amy Goodman, WBI's news director at the time, wanted to be host and most prominent contributor to the kickoff show, which meant that the consensus decision was being undermined. This would put WBAI program director Samori Marksman and general manager Valerie Van Eisler in a compromising position. But Amy didn't care about that. As Amy saw it, their job was to make it happen the way she wanted it, which meant excluding everybody else, including other veteran Pacifica news people who were at least equally deserving of a shot. Now, when Democracy Now! Kicked off, I remember Amy as the ferocious tearing Bush's throat out in 1988. After the assassination of Ben Linder. What do you mean, no quid pro quo? What do you call the interviews or certificates? You know, like nobody else. Then she's got, okay, back to this. To achieve this, Amy kicked out. Okay, as Amy saw it, there was jobs to make it happen the way she wanted it, which meant excluding everybody else, including other veteran and news people who were at least equally deserving of a shot. To achieve this, Amy kicked her hammering of Samori and Valerie into high gear and had supporters, quote-unquote, that is, wealthy donors, call them to express their desire that Amy host the program. Sadly, Samori, surprisingly, and Valerie, not surprisingly, capitulated. Amy, as usual, got what she wanted. I told Amy I could almost move to New York to listen to Democracy Now! Or to listen to her. And she said, well, she sounded like with considerable relief, well, now you don't have to. But, never mind. I and several others later learned took Samori to task for caving in. Just when Pacifica was beginning to behave like a network with all parties' stations working cooperatively to achieve a great thing, it all came undone by WBI resident Enfant Terrible. Why did you go along with the program? I asked Samori in a private one-on-one. He said he felt badly about it, but at the time the decision, quote, had been made to go with Amy, unquote. He said he wasn't happy about what had happened, but added that the saving grace was that Amy would do a credible job and that he would help her programmatically to make Democracy Now! Work. He also said that he hadn't given up on the original plan, alternating hosts from all the stations, which of course never happened. It wasn't long before Amy upped the ante. She wanted no interference, i.e. no supervision or input from anyone, especially National Program Director Steve Yasko, whose job it was to assure the integrity and quality of Pacifica programming and to supervise its content. She wanted to be the program's permanent host. No other host and no rotation of hosts. Everyone else was to be locked out. Then came another demand. Amy wanted the program to be a Pacifica must-carry, meaning that all Pacifica stations would be ordered to air the program, whether they wanted to or not, and she wanted it to air in morning drive time, again as a must-carry directive from National. She wanted the must-carry edict to apply to afternoon drive times as well. Note that her new position as host and virtually only voice on DN was in addition to her presence as co-host of Wake Up Call, the program immediately following DN, and also her presence on the regular news hour in the evening. In other words, Amy would now be the host and or leading figure in not one, but three of the station's most important programs, airing every day in prime time, the effect of which was to turn WBI and Pacifica Network into a promotion machine for her new and growing business enterprise. And that wasn't all. For an extraordinary example of triple dipping, unique in Pacifica and perhaps anywhere else in broadcasting, she demanded and received a salary for each of those three programs. Finally, and perhaps even more extraordinary, was her demand for an extensive personal staff to be paid for by WBAI and Pacifica, but over which no one at Pacifica, including its national program director, Yasgo, was to have any input or control as to hiring or salary. She also demanded an additional discretionary budget for DN, separate from the regular payroll, which she would also control, free of oversight or interference, quote-unquote, from anyone at WBI or Pacifica. So although the foundation was to bear the cost, it was Amy who placed herself in charge of setting the rules. Then came a demand for a dedicated office in Washington, D.C., since she said the DN program would focus heavily on national politics. But no sooner were arrangements made to accommodate that demand than she added yet another new one. She said, needed office space in New York, complete with its own exclusive support services, computers, phones, fax, etc., plus the right to take over for her own exclusive use the production units that WBI's programmers shared for the station's other shows, which meant that it became routine that Amy and or her staff would suddenly show up and commandeer all the station's production studios and facilities, leaving all of WBI's other producers to figure out how to deal with the resulting production traffic jam. As far as Amy was concerned, any problems or disruptions she caused were irrelevant. Democracy Now! Was now the network flagship program with her at the helm, and therefore no obstacles should be tolerated nor expense spared to produce it. In effect, Amy had wrested the Pacifica program from Pacifica, fashioned it in an undemocratic way by locking out Pacifica personnel who should have shared the hosting of the program, made Pacifica pick up a very substantial tab for its production, which went way beyond projected cost, and for all intents and purposes owned the program. After the death of Samori Marksman, March 23, 99, Amy went full blast with DN and literally rebranded the program as her personal property. An investigation into this will expose sub rosa dealings that were arranged and concluded without the board's full knowledge and approval, and a simultaneous campaign of terror that Amy instigated and choreographed in order first to arrogate the program to herself as a private enterprise, secondly to run that private enterprise with Pacifica's money, personnel, and material assets, thirdly to rebrand and use the program as the hub for other related financial endeavors of her own. Fourthly, as a scheme to enrich herself while systematically indebting Pacifica, and ultimately to use the program and her heavily promoted identification with it as co-founder and host, quote-unquote, to cause grave economic harm to Pacifica, including possible dissolutions, thus positioning herself advantageously as a logical and worthy inheritor should the network be forced to part with any of all of its assets. Or probably it says any or all. Should have said. When National Program Director Steve Yasko, an affable, openly gay man, attempted to shape DN editorially into what the program was originally designed to be, that is, when he tried to do his job, Amy went into out-and-out war mode, a tactic she would repeat with other targets during the course of this whole debacle. She leaked supposedly confidential memos from her to Yasko, deftly written to convey the false impression she was being harassed by him, that he had created a horrible, hostile work environment, and in what would become her constant theme, that Pacifica was trying to take her program away from her and was subjecting her to censorship, unquote. She and her staff concocted and spread vile, horrible lies about Yasko throughout the network, suggesting he was a mean and hateful man who had not yet worked out his latent self-loathing and never had an inability to deal with strong heterosexual feminists such as Amy Goodman. It was a carefully choreographed and relentless smear campaign. As a result, Yasko began receiving threatening phone calls from irate listeners, and people began showing up at WPFW, Pacifica's Washington, D.C. station, and at Yasko's Washington, D.C. residence to physically and psychologically intimidate him. He literally began to get sick, losing sleep, losing weight, fearful that he was being followed and might be attacked, and worried that even if he quit, he was so maligned by Amy and her putrid lies that his chances of landing a meaningful job in the industry would be extremely low. These tactics were accompanied by a blitz of lawsuits by Amy against the Pacifica Foundation, alleging harassment, civil rights violation, hostile work environment, and other despicable lies. The aim was not only to keep Pacifica on the defensive, but also bankrupt it. Foundation naturally had to hire lawyers to defend against Amy's spurious charges, which she filed through her union, AFTRA, and through a battalion of well-connected, wealthy, liberal lawyer friends. Pacifica spent millions of dollars dealing with Amy's lawsuits, which she reported to the public not as a plaintiff, but as a poor, helpless, beleaguered victim fighting a noble battle against an evil Pacifica that was trying to take her program from her. The AFTRA union reps themselves intensely disliked Amy and were also fed up with her and her many obviously frivolous complaints. They objected to having to represent her in a self-serving war against Pacifica. They concluded that she had cost the union more than any other individual in recent memory and found her to be extremely difficult to work with. They resented being used as a weapon to carry out personal agenda against her employer by concocting an utterly false narrative that she was an earnest worker unjustly wronged. When she realized that AFTRA was not going to be enthusiastic play in her game plan, she had her lawyers' friends take up the slack and pick up the pace. These were the same lawyers who 3 years later would write the one-sided Democracy Now! Contract that privatized and then gave away the program on which Pacifica had expended millions of dollars to create, staff, and produce to Amy's privately owned corporation. Incidentally, Amy was the only worker at WBAI who belonged to AFTRA, which was the regular union for broadcasting personnel. But for reasons lost in the midst of history, WBAI's workers incomprehensibly were part of an electrical workers union bargaining unit. As a shop steward, I constantly asked why workers at a radio station weren't members of the industry union. As the only AFTRA member at WBAI, Amy was the paid industry standard, was paid the industry standard rate and enjoyed benefits that no one else at WBAI enjoyed. At one point, interim general manager Latrice Lead recommended to Pacifica's executive director, Bessie Wash, that WBAI should pursue a transfer of the shop to AFTRA. Although normally unions don't take kindly to the other unions raiding their members, in this instance, both AFTRA and UE were extremely cooperative about a possible handover, both unions marveling at the rarity of a case in which management was actually taking the lead and doing the right thing by workers. Neither union had ever conducted a handover before, but both expended their best good faith efforts to make it happen. And so it did. Such was the kind of change that Pacifica Executive Director Bessie wanted for Pacifica. The union transferred raised salaries for all employees and provided benefits they never had before, including catastrophic care and retirement benefits. Bernard White, Amy's devoted but hopelessly duped acolyte, was later able to draw upon his AFTRA benefits when he was dealing with major health challenge. But guess who openly opposed the move to AFTRA and worked feverishly behind the scenes to torpedo it? Yes, Amy Goodman. She resented other workers having the same benefits she might singularly enjoyed it, that she singularly enjoyed at WBAI, and did everything in her power to derail the handover. But this was one time, perhaps the only time, in which she did not get her way. Sometime around 2000-2002, the foundation's national headquarters, amid considerable protests throughout the network, was relocated from Berkeley to Washington, D.C. Shortly thereafter, WBAI's interim general manager, Latrice Lead, was sent to Washington, D.C. to become national program director, replacing Steve Yasko, who had been terrorized out of his job by Amy Goodman's smear campaign, as noted above. Bob Daughtry, the general manager at WPFW, the D.C. station, replaced Lead as interim general manager at WBAI in New York. Lead said that her very first meeting with the national news staff in D.C. turned into a grief session about Amy. They demanded to know, is Amy Goodman coming here? Lead said that she didn't know, and when she asked why they asked the question, they replied that they would all quit if she did come to D.C. To put it mildly, they did not like her at all, neither on a personal nor professional level. They were unanimous in their position that they would quit rather than have Amy physically present among them or even in the same building. Soon after her arrival in D.C., Lead and the national news staff set to work strengthening the regular one-hour news national news program that they produced daily for Pacifica. They also wanted to create a new Pacifica news hour, which would amplify a news story or two covered in the regular news program. It was a good idea, and Lead, as national news director, said she would go with it. I worked with Lead and the national news team and found them to be great people. A small, culturally diverse of serious journalists who loved the work they did and worked well with each other. They performed well under pressure and impressed everyone with their desire to stretch out and do even more. Lead began a practice of short daily editorial meetings that included the sound engineers, and this small team delivered every day two self-contained, highly produced news and feature story programs that many, including myself, felt far superior to DN and at no extra cost, neither to the news unit or to Pacifica. This team also increased the distribution of the program by increasing the number of affiliates that wanted it, and the money from those offices went into the Pacifica coffers. All omens and auguries bode well for this news program, except one. Amy Goodman viewed it as unwanted rival for audience attention that might steal some of the thunder from her own, quote-unquote, Democracy Now! Program. Going after the whole enchilada. Oh, I'm reading. Well, it doesn't say what I'm reading. In a crisis, particularly one that is engineered, there is Machiavellian opportunity. By manipulation and tantrum, the wily Ms. Goodman had gained the power traction she desired within WBAI. But in the course of her campaign, however, she and her coven of co-conspirators saw that it was also possible to go after the whole enchilada and take over the entire network the way she snatched his prize, Democracy Now!, of which she continues to name herself co-founder, although as a devout meist, she never names the co part of her putative title. And as Samori Marksman was news director, it was his show. Until the company from which you take funds killed him, I believe. Heart attack, no excuse. During the heart attack cluster, probable cause. It's not beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's probable cause. Although as a devout man, astute player of the race card, she leaned heavily on African Americans at WBI to vouch for her credentials as a righteous sister. They performed their task well. At a meeting in Harlem to condemn then interim GM Utrecht's lead, Robert Knight, an African American and the station's award-winning investigative journalist, proclaimed to a packed house that Amy Goodman is the blackest woman I know. Unquote. He was, in fact, not lying because Knight didn't actually know many black women, and they evidently returned the favor. No, writer of this report is an African-American, Steve Brown. Unquote. Or that's a parenthesis. Editorial note. Okay, this is from Steve Brown. Pacifica's, one of those emails list I'm on. This was, of course, before Knight eventually ran afoul of Bernard White, was ignominiously kicked out of the elite circles of the Goodman-Gonzalez-led Pacifica campaign, and then, after White became de facto general manager of WBI, was fired from his job at the station altogether. Meanwhile, Bernard White, Bob Lederer, Mimi Rosenberg, Vajra Kilgore, and the passel of Amy bots went on polluting WBAI airways with Antica Pacifica vitriol as part of the effort by the Pacifica campaign to discredit and dislodge the national board. Pacifica campaign is in capital, so there's probably a formal group called that. To dislodge national board and seize control of the network. Their black adherents were especially useful when it was necessary to attack other blacks, in which they sometimes earned extra points for twofers. That is, not simply attacking black women, but black women who also held positions of power and influence within Pacifica. Bernard White was official door opener for the full-scale attack on all black folks in leadership positions at Pacifica, i.e. anyone Amy saw as an impediment to her takeover plan, and gave the public the illusion that their war against Pacifica was principle-driven and race-neutral. But in fact, it was anything but. For example, the planning sessions for Amy's anti-Pacific assaults that took place at WBI day after day were heavily segregated by race. The black meetings, including few or no whites, and the meetings of Amy's people included almost no one of color. The blacks who were enlisted to support Amy were selected for their high visibility, people in practically all spheres of life. She was soon able to, quote, prove, unquote, her legitimacy and credibility among black folks across the spectrum, from Harry Belafonte to Mumia Abu-Jamal, but not all of them could be fooled forever. For example, Pam Africa, a spokesperson for Mumia, actually apologized to Utrecht's lead publicly during a recent community meeting in Brooklyn, at which I was a witness, Steve Brown, that is, not DJ Mel, in which Steve Brown was a witness for allowing Pam Africa and Mumia to be used that way. She told the audience that she came to realize there was another agenda afoot. Quote, as revolutionaries, we have to make things right, unquote. She said, asking to be forgiven a lapse in revolutionary judgment, I firmly believe that Amy and company needed to feel that they had strong black support before going full tilt on taking over the entire network. But hard as they tried to get that support, especially in New York and D.C., it just wasn't forthcoming. That was clear when, in spite of the protests and demonstrations against her, by Bernard White and the Amy Goodman Juan Gonzalez Pacific campaign, interim GM lead succeeded in implementing the most successful fund drive in WBI history, even jamming the station's phone line pledge lines and sending operatives into the tally room to nullify pledge cards couldn't sabotage the drive, which raised $1.2 million, most of it by credit cards in just over 2 weeks. And this was accomplished by offering very few premiums, opting instead for direct appeal based on the quality of programming. The result of that successful drive was a decisive blow to the imagined credibility that the Goodman-Gonzalez-White faction supposedly enjoyed with the listeners, and quite possibly persuaded Amy that the push to take over the entire Pacifica network should be delayed for fear of public sentiment turning against them. However, delaying the plan didn't mean canceling the plan. Amy still intends to own Pacifica one day. In the meantime, she is carefully placing her people in parallel systems. One such is the Manhattan Neighborhood Network cable television system. When MNN refused to allow her, quote, her, unquote, DN program to dominate its programming schedule and take over a significant amount of its physical space and production equipment, she went after the MNN station manager, an African-American man whose name I can't recall right now. Note, I believe the head of MNN referred to was Anthony Riddle, who later became WBAI general manager. That was a note by Steve Brown, author of this piece. With a laundry list of false accusations and complaints against him, she then launched an email campaign against him, and with the aid of her ally Leslie Kagan, Leslie Kagan, who was a former Pacifica National Board Chair, was the person who negotiated and signed in secret the infamous Democracy Now! Contract that privatized Democracy Now! And gave it away to Amy Goodman's private corporation. That's Steve Brown note. Leslie Kagan got him fired and succeeded in having Dan Coughlin, her former employee and former Pacifica ED, hired to replace him. Anthony Riddle. Yeah, so Kagan got Riddle fired and replaced with Dan Coughlin. It was also Amy's political clout and Leslie Kagan's influence at the national level that helped Coughlin land the top job at Pacifica and as executive director in 2002. After protested, but to no avail, returning to his old Amy-like ways, Coughlin was fired in 2005 for unaccountable borrowing of funds to the national office, secret bonuses to key employees, and lack of transparency. I remember when Amy was on special assignment back in the old days at WBAI, Coughlin had been an employee of Amy's as Democracy Now! Producer. He often ran down the hall to Utrice Lee's office in desperation to ask her what the stories he should put on upcoming episodes of DN. She readily helped until she heard and saw him berating a DN intern for not understanding the importance of knowing what the story is. Strange things began to happen at WBAI. Strange things after Amy, having outworn her welcome in Washington, D.C., returned to her office at WBAI and continued producing DN and simultaneously direct the misinformation and terror campaign she was leading with Juan Gonzalez, Bernard White, Bob Lederer, and others against Pacifica's executive director and national board. This was just prior to a total blowout at WBAI. At that time, we began to see people coming into the station whom no one knew. They were everywhere and made free use of WBAI's phone, fax machine, copier, stationery supplies. They walked around the station with an air of authority as if they belonged there and nobody was to ask them any questions. They all seemed to be reporting to the far end of the hall where Amy Goodman and Bernard White had adjoining offices. Because these people preempted so much of the station's space and facilities, those of us trying to do our work found ourselves having to readjust our normal work functions and schedule around these unnameless Amy people. It was not unusual that on some days every space dedicated to our work was occupied. The performance studios, production studios, conference room that we used as a tally room during pledge drives, kitchen area, reception area, all the phones and computer bank that adjoined the newsroom. We were inundated with all kinds of people invading the station. The only thing we could do was to hole up in our offices until airtime and keep the doors locked until we returned to our offices after our shows. WBI was transformed into Protest Central, and at the direction of Amy and Bernard, various groups performed their assigned tasks, making anti-Pacifica protest signs, using the phone bank to make private calls, sending faxes out, holding planning meetings, producing anti-Pacifica cards and other audios in the production studios, all with the aim of destabilizing the network and dislodging its current management and government, but having nothing at all to do with the business of running WBAI as a radio station. Many colleagues and I began asking ourselves, what the hell is going on here? Why is Valerie allowing this? It was Amy's people, quote-unquote, getting ready for action, we were told. It got worse. People were roaming around the station doing what nobody knew. They were even sleeping in overnight. The station looked and smelled like hell. The cleaning staff filed complaints with the manager of the building about the conditions of WBAI's offices, which forced them to do so much cleaning every night that it threw them way back on their cleaning schedule. Our neighbors on the floor complained about the filthy conditions of the bathrooms. Things went missing at WBAI and equipment frequently was out of order. Soon it all became unambiguously clear. Amy's people were preparing for a huge protest and grand assault and physical occupation of the station based on the lies and distortions that she, Bernard White, and others had spread over the airwaves throughout the network. Although a network-wide takeover was the goal, WBAI was to take the lead. Valerie herself didn't seem to object about what was going on, even though we asked her as general manager to do something about it. Not only because we personally didn't feel safe, but also because the station and all of its equipment for which she was legally and morally responsible were being used and abused by people who couldn't care less about the safety of staff, personnel, or the station's facilities. Someone apparently reported the planned takeover of the station to Pacifica ED Bessie Wash. I got a call from her one evening. I had stayed late to prepare my show for the following day. I had never met Bessie, but she told me who she was and why she was calling. She said she had heard some distressing things from talking to people at the station. She did not identify them. She said they all asked her to talk to me and to Utrice Lee to corroborate what they had said. I told her exactly what I saw and what was developing at the station. Many of us were very uncomfortable with the arbitrary and reckless decisions by Amy and Bernard and their followers to put the rest of us and the station itself in danger by this attempted takeover. And I expressed these concerns to Bessie. I told her, and even though we reported our concerns to Valerie, nothing was done. In fact, on the very day Bessie talked to me, Amy's people had decided on the precise day they were going to take over the station, and I even heard some of them talking about bringing guns for an armed showdown. Bessie asked me who had been letting the non-WBI people into the station during the preceding weeks to conduct their campaign against Pacifica. I told her that they let themselves in because there was no lock on the front door. Astonishingly, WBI had been in its new space at 120 Wall Street for a considerable time, but had no lock on its front door, despite entreaties to Valerie to safeguard the station and anyone working there, especially late at night. Bessie thanked me for talking with her. She also congratulated Dutrice Lead, at that time host of the popular afternoon show Talkback, for winning a recent vote by WBAI programmers who thought she was best suited to be program director for the station. Actually, Lead hadn't even run. Errol Maitland, who very often engineered for Amy and Wake Up Call, had entered her name on his own as the best person for the job. Lead won convincingly, as it turned out. Laura Flanders was second. 2 days after our initial conversation, I got another call from Bessie telling me that she would be in town that evening to meet with Utrice Lead. At that meeting, according to Utrice Lead, Bessie said that the conversation she had with Lead and other staffers concerned her greatly, but that she had come to New York to take some executive actions the following day since Valerie was not responding to the station, although FCC law requires the broadcast license holder to take all reasonable measures to protect the broadcasting facilities. Bessie said there was General Manager Valerie, who clearly aware that something awful was brewing, was doing nothing to secure the space and equipment of the station's personnel. Additionally, the contemplated action by Amy's people, if true, would expose Pacific to all kinds of legal problems. Should someone be injured or worse during the planned occupation of WBI, of which the general manager had knowledge but did not respond accordingly. Bessie told me she had come to New York to secure the station herself. The front door had no lock at all, so a lock had to be installed, and people roaming all over the station and having access to and using equipment in rooms and offices that should be locked meant that someone had keys or access to keys for all the offices and studios and opened them. Those locks had to be changed, Bessie said. A locksmith was contracted the next day and was asked to do the job late in the evening to avoid any run-ins with protesters. There were several WBAI employees, I won't name them, who, like me, were outraged that Amy and some of our so-called colleagues didn't care about and never asked us what we thought. Our view was that whatever their beef was with Pacifica, they were dead wrong to orchestrate a takeover of the station, disregarding the safety of others and the very real possibility that the equipment that listeners' money had paid for would be stolen, damaged, or destroyed. We all agreed that the chief antagonist in this drama were engaging in a CIA type of operation, propagating false information to mobilize people, many of them sincere and well-meaning, behind contrivances that hid the real reason for their anti-Pacifica protests and actions. We weren't in a war with anybody. We just wanted to make sure that the station, the physical plant, and its equipment would not fall into the hands of misguided zealots who were acting like they had nothing to lose. Utrice confided to her colleague what Bessie Wash was about to do in order to ensure the safety of the station. They breathed a sigh of relief and turned over their office keys to her, each key representing one lock that did not have to be changed, an expense avoided. The locksmith brought his journeyman son to assist him, and Bessie, an assistant with baby in tow, and Utrice Lead and I were there keeping them company and making sure everything went smoothly. A late night host who saw what was going on, there was no attempt to hide it from him, began reporting the non-event with the urgency of an air raid, and thus began the next wave of propaganda, the so-called Christmas coup. If three unarmed women and a baby could carry out a coup, it doesn't say much for the other side's tactical capabilities, does it? If anything, it was a Christmas counter-coup to prevent the plan of Bernard White and the rest of Amy's people to celebrate Christmas as their new owner, as the new owners of WBI. A further report may be forthcoming from the source, but this is all I have right now. Steve Brown. And let me skip up and see if I can get down to the part where I started. I'll skip Steve a little introductory. It's called Amy's Grandpa's Gift Keeps on Giving to Amy. Amy Goodman's grandfather, a rabbi of the Orthodox tradition, I was told, had made a long-term charitable pledge to WBAI that would continue even after his death. Ostensibly, the gift was an acknowledgement of the opportunities provided to his granddaughter by the station to learn her craft and do the kinds of stories she otherwise would not have been assigned to as a mere intern in a typical newsroom setting. His gift also was a way of assuring that Amy would find few, if any, impediments to success in her chosen career at WBAI. It had to have been a generous gift because it was repeatedly leveraged by Amy to allow her to do as she pleased. Even as a new arrival in the news department, she did what she wanted, functioning apart from the regular staff and doing stories on her own, making it clear she was above taking direction and was quite special, truly an exception to the rulers, quote unquote, as she proclaims about her program. To say that she was driven is an understatement. Amy poured herself into her work and was single-minded in developing her reportorial skills, mentored by colleagues in this regard. Although I never heard her credit anyone, her conduct in the workplace, however, was atrocious, and she seemed to take great pride in her being unmanageable, characterized by epic tantrums, blowouts, meltdowns, screaming at and cussing out others, and displaying a persona so aggressive and intimidating that people tended to get out of her way, and in the case of management, especially Valerie Van Isler and Samori Marksman, tended to give her whatever she demanded for the sake of peace, to make her happy. What made happy was getting whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted it. She was not a team player in the news department. She felt she was the news department, and it was important to her that everyone, including those who were showing her the ropes of the trade, understand and accept that. That mindset applied beyond the news department. Amy was not only became a star at WBI, she felt she was WBI. Her self-importance and narcissism knew no bounds. It contrasted dramatically with the humble, shy girl image she portrayed to the public. I note here that a key figure in her development as news reporter was WBAI's legendary program director, Samori Marksman, who seemed to be the only person with whom Amy would mind her P's and Q's. She would not have had either the political ideological perspective to access the broad spectrum of contact she now enjoys had it not been for him. He was that kind of person. He'd offer whatever help one needed to produce a good piece of work for WBAI. It is no exaggeration to say Samori principally was responsible for introducing Amy to a world she never knew and the people she never would have been able to connect with. Needless to say, in short order, she commandeered his contacts too and made them her own. Chomsky, Zinn, Vidal, Belafonte, Tony Benn, Dick Gregory, etc. I've never heard her credit or thank Samori publicly for his contribution to her professional development. Soon it became clear that Amy was actually her own news division within the news department. She would commandeer interns who should have been rotated throughout the department and make them work strictly on the stories she was doing and nothing else. With this free help, she was able to tackle stories more complex than run-of-the-mill variety. She was obsessed with recognition, awards, and prizes that credit only Amy Goodman. News department was no longer a cooperative. It became Amy Goodman's Great Journalism Incorporated and stuff from second- and third-tier people. Things got exceptionally worse when she demanded to be appointed to the position of WBAI's news director, using as leverage her grandfather's gift, which, as she made very clear to the timid and compliant general manager, Valerie Van Isler, she could easily stop. Which would in turn reflect poorly on Valerie with Pacifica's executive director and executive board. Amy's appointment as news director by Valerie Van Isler benefited both of them. Valerie was abysmal as a general manager, both alienated and alienating, generally disapproved of by staff and dedicated to impeding progress on just about everything. Amy treated her with uniform disregard, even joining up a petition to replace Valerie. A call by WBAI staffers for Valerie's resignation or dismissal made her even more subservient to Amy. And I'm going to go skip all this other personal drama to go to the real, actual horror story of today.
Remnants of the ISIS terrorist forces, so much so that the Iraqi prime minister has just today, that is today, Tuesday, the 29th of December, has just visited the town of Ramadi, and looks like he got in there and out of there alive. The last center of fighting had been around on the government center, the government buildings in this city, but there ISIS was driven out, and they're down to a couple of hundred fighters. So they're being mopped up. The prime minister of the country has been there. Nevertheless, the poor people here at the Washington Post You're going to see defeatism oozing out of every pore. They want these elites, both reactionary and left-wing, politically correct, whatever you want. They want to have ISIS hang on longer. So here we have Washington Post of this morning, Tuesday, December 29th. Government forces appeared close to capturing the capital of Iraq's largest province from the Islamic State on Monday, dealing a potentially significant blow to the militant group as it loses territory in both Iraq and Syria. Yes, indeed. The troops are celebrating in the middle of the town. The Iraqi flag is up. Iraqi tanks are in the streets, and it only appears. The prime minister has come and gone. I hope the appearances will solidify themselves into reality for the defeatists and appeasers, really, at the Washington Post. So this is another. This is a big one because of the fall of Sinjar on November 11th, the great fortress, right, the great Gibraltar of ISIS there in the middle of the road complex, the main road to Mosul. Well, it fell within 24, 48 hours at the very most. And we've still got these think tankers, right, the Beltway bandits on the Pentagon payroll telling us it's going to take 10 years, it's going to take 20 years, it's going to take 30 years, it's going to be the new 100 years war. Well, none of the above. ISIS is a paper tiger. The only reason that ISIS stands is because of the corruption and stupidity of all of its adversaries, all of them, because otherwise that supply line would have been cut. And don't tell me that anybody is free from the opprobrium of not doing that in 2015. It is called the Jarablus Corridor. We've talked about it. It starts at the Euphrates River, starts with the town of Jarablus on the west bank of the Euphrates River, goes about 100 kilometers, and that's the principal, and at this point really the only important supply corridor for the ISIS terrorists, right? Most of the rest of that border has been seized by the Kurds, despite constant attacks by the treacherous and wily Erdogan of Turkey. So close the Jarablus corridor. This is our demand to the world, our challenge to the world, indeed, as we put out on Christmas Eve. The entire world community has to face the fact that the Jarablus corridor has got to be closed. And the fact that it has not been closed, not by the U.S., not by Russia, not by anybody, is an indictment of human civilization in our time. Back in a minute. World Crisis Radio. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Mr. Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. It's our newest program, although taped a little bit in advance on the afternoon of the 29th of December. Best program recorded in 2015, first program broadcast in 2016. Happy New Year to everyone. And time to gird your loins for the battles to come, in which, indeed, civilization is still in the gravest danger. Thank you. if only because it's now New Year's under the shadow of fascism, the hideous fascism of Trump, Cruz, and other reactionaries who are now evolving into outright fascists. And we'll try to discuss some of the problems involved with that process in our second hour here. Now, Ramadi has essentially been liberated by the Iraqi army. Hats off to the Iraqi army. We notice that this disgusting Ashton Carter, right, Dr. Strangelove, the utopian pedant butcher, Ashton Carter, he needs to be fired. He needed to be fired the very day that he got into the Pentagon, right? He seems to think that he's a state within a state, right? A little bit like the SS under Himmler, right? They did what they wanted, right? And they made their stuff up. Every time that Ashton Carter announces more troops for Syria or someplace like this, you really wonder, does he do that all on his own? Does he ask Obama, is there any constitutional process? Does he think that he's the warlord of the of that Bank of the Potomac over there in Arlington, Virginia, Crystal City, Pentagon City? It's hard to tell with this guy because he doesn't seem to be doing it in the name of anybody but himself. So a Strangelove, to be sure, right? Because he's one of those defense intellectuals, right? He's one of those guys in the tradition of Herman Kahn, right? And Herman Kahn was on nuclear war, including world targets and mega deaths and all the rest of it. That's Ashton Carter, and we want him out. As far as the Iraqi army is concerned, kudos to them. Ashton Carter seemed to have a perverse delight in insulting them when the situation emerged about a year and a half ago, right? When the town of Ramadi and some others, right, be it Tikrit or Fallujah, were captured by ISIS, and the Iraqi army dissolved. And Ashton Carter got out there and said, the Iraqi soldiers ran away. Not quite accurate, Ash. It was the generals who ran away. It was the officers who ran away. And this is exactly, for example, what we had in the fall of France in May of 1940. We have very interesting first-person accounts of French pro-fascist, pro-Hitler officers putting their families into cars and driving away from the front and leaving the troops with nobody, right? And then in that case, the army disintegrates. And we know that the problem of the Iraqi army, of course, was it had been bribed under Mad Dog Bush the Elder already back in 1990-1991. The officers were bribed that they should not resist in Kuwait. Then the place, it was the army was severely battered and bribed again in 2003 before they sent in the second Mad Dog Bush family attack on Iraq. The officers were again bribed by the CIA, by the Saudis, by others. And then, excuse me. It's a good.
Good time for DJ Mouse to jump in with, what about the other Bremer? Okay, Paul Bremer, he's talking about the Viceroy or whatever appointed. Now, Marsh McLennan was one of those, it was like the zeroed in on the computers so they could destroy him. Having all the people that were outside the loop in the company shredded along with that paper trail. Remember Amy saying in New Jersey or Brooklyn or something, the office paper are coming down like confetti from the explosion of the towers. Of course, that's not a plane hitting it. That is Bremer. Arthur Bremer's cousin, let's say. Of course, he was the one that Nixon used to take out the spoiler racist Wallace that, I didn't know that he was any more racist than Nixon, but they're like, of course, all racists, and so Never mind. That's the Arthur Bremmer he's talking about, the cousin of Paul Bremmer. Because they never say no relation to Arthur Bremmer when they say Paul Bremmer. He was on TV that morning. He was not at his work, which was targeted, as he well knew.
Bowman, huh? The next round of bribery apparently has happened now in the auspices of ISIS. But again, the bribery is from Saudi Arabia. And of course, in the middle of all this, the Iraqi army was destroyed by Jerry Bremmer. Remember him? He's up there. Don't worry about him. He's in there circling around the Beltway as a Beltway bandit, getting all kinds of money as a consultant. So he was the one who said destroy the Iraqi army. And the entire drama since then comes from that insane decision, which needed to be overridden by little G.W. Bush. But, of course, the Mad Dog Bush family is one of the principal centers of evil in the modern world, so they didn't do it. So you can thank Jerry Bremmer for this current situation. So the Iraqi army has proven that if they get some decent leadership, they're about as good as anybody, especially when it comes to fighting the butchers of ISIS, who, as we know, represent the negation of all civilization. It doesn't matter what religion, it's the negation of civilization. Now, a couple of other things have happened. We have the liquidation by the Syrian Arab Army, in conjunction with the Russian Air Force. They have killed a person by the name of Zakran Alush. And Zakran Alush is one of the top honchos of the Jaish al-Islam, the Islamic Army. This is right in the close-in suburbs of Damascus. It's amazing. I know I stayed when I was there 4 years ago. I was in the Bait al-Wali, one of the finest hotels in the world. That was out on the eastern edge, towards the eastern edge, right? You go to St. Thomas's Gate, Bab Tuma, and you were practically, you were inside the old walls, but sort of on the eastern side. Now, this incident took place in the little bit 4 kilometers south of Damascus, and he was got the joint operation. And this was in the middle of a process by which, under the auspices of Stefan de Mistura of the United Nations, a bunch of defeated ISIS fighters and killers were being put into buses to be shipped under UN auspices over to Raqqa to get them out of the Damascus area, where they can do tremendous mischief, right? You can't have a bunch of dangerous suicidal fanatics within 4 kilometers of your capital city. Why? They might, you know, some fine midnight or 3 a.m. in the morning or whatever, or some afternoon, decide to make a rush for your government buildings. And you've got to make sure that that is not allowed to happen. So.
Wow. Oh, yeah, this was the Guide to the End of the World. So how does that go? Well, in the horrible 80s in Central America, it was Dorothy escorting the Contras to the hospital to get the bullets taken out of her head. And then they go back to their Contra buddies who are, like, attacking the women's clinic that she works at, saying, "You can't kill her. She's the only one taking care of our families." See how we have to escort these Contras to protect them, actually, as bodyguards in that fashion. Now, this is just intellectually running through it, because we've been to this through the end of the world business. That's the final hell of increasing doom, is de donde vengo, you know, and that's too long a story to get into, but we'll be right back.
Hear the sound of the faces in